When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to Immigrantly, a podcast that deconstructs immigrant identity one story at a time. I am Sadia Khan. Thank you so much for spending this time with me in this space. Now, my voice is a bit raspy because I have sore throat, but that did not stop me from recording yet another episode for all of you. So thank you for being with me on this journey to explore different layers of human experiences. My today's guest is Yusuf Dahl. He is an entrepreneur and educator. His story is about survival. It's about growth. It is inspiring for most, but it also underlines systemic racism that exists within our society. Now, growing up in Milwaukee, Yusuf found himself in prison at 18 years old, facing nearly 60 years in prison for the possession of drugs. Yusuf turned his life around after getting sentenced to 10 years and serving 5. He was determined to make a difference in his community during the foreclosure crisis, and so he founded his company, Milwaukee Metro Management. Since then, he has graduated with a master's degree from Princeton University and served as the director of entrepreneurship and innovation at Lafayette College. Today, I'll talk to Yusuf about his journey, his story of success and survival, as well as his thoughts on this country's prison system and its impact on people. So let's get started. How are you doing?
I'm well, thank you.
Thank you for coming on Immigrantly, Yusuf. I am really excited to talk to you because I have read your story. I've done some research. I think there are some stories that warrant the individual to tell them. And I think you'll do justice to it. So I will ask you to tell your story.
My story is really one of, I would say, incredible fortune. And quite frankly, good luck. I was born in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, a great city, but like a lot of our great cities in this country, it's a tale of two cities. And so there's parts of Milwaukee that are full of opportunity and are vibrant and are culturally and intellectually rich. And there's other parts that are underinvested and neglected. And that's the part of the city that I grew up in. And, you know, at a very young age, just kind of fell in with the bad crowd, made poor decisions. And when I was 18 years old, I found myself sentenced to prison for 10 years for the distribution of drugs. But really, just through a lot of hard work and good fortune, have been able to build a very different life for myself and my family, and had the great fortune of learning how to build software when I was behind bars. A fellow inmate who was there for embezzlement actually taught me how to program computers, and that led to a career that's taken me to 3 continents to build software. Was able to start a successful business in property management and investment, and really have just been able to completely change the trajectory for my family. And so it's a story that I'm very appreciative of, and for all the folks who have extended opportunity for me, and really animates my desire to want to pay that forward and extend opportunity to others.
So your story is a story of great survival, fortune, good luck.
Yes.
But sometimes stories like yours, however inspiring they may be, they may take away from systemic problems that exist within American societies. There is this disconnect between what you did and what others may not be able to do because the odds are stacked against a lot of individuals in America, right? Mm-hmm. So how do you draw that line where you are celebrating your success, but you're also talking about the systemic issues that exist within American society?
You know, my older brother was sentenced to prison. My father was sentenced to prison. That's as far back as I can go with my family. So every meaningful adult that I'm aware of that was in my family, every meaningful male adult had the same exact experience that I did. When we think about the crime that I was sentenced to prison for, African Americans make up 6% of the Wisconsin population. They're 53% of the people who are sentenced to prison for drug distribution. Do we really think that Blacks sell that many more drugs than other demographics? Of course not. And so I operate, I start from the position that things are not equal, right? It's not a level playing field. And I've always operated my life under the understanding that I was going to have to work harder than other people, right? I was going to have to sacrifice more than other people. And ultimately for me, all of that hard work and all of that sacrifice is so that my daughter doesn't have those same disadvantages. And because of the good fortune that I've had in life, because of some of the success, quite frankly, my daughter will not have it as hard as I did. Does that mean it's going to be a completely level playing field for her as well? No, but her trajectory is very, very different than mine. And so, you know, when I talk to people who, you know, maybe are in the situation that I was in 20 years ago, I'm very candid that you're going to have to work harder than you probably should have to work, right? Because you're starting from a position of disadvantage, but what are you going to do about it, right? Like at the end of the day, my responsibility as the head of my family is to make those sacrifices so that future generations don't have to.
What are some of the sacrifices that you made?
Well, you know, my daughter, who's now 15, she'll be the first to tell you that her dad's not a lot of fun. She'll say, "Dad, you're always working, or you're always talking about work, or you're always, you know, making me do extra work." And so I have prioritized the financial stability of my family, and, you know, not just the financial stability, but the stability overall, right? And a lot of the instability, at least that I experienced as a young person, stemmed from the financial insecurity of my family. And so that has been of paramount importance for me. And so that meant, especially as a young man, even before my daughter was born, when a lot of my friends picked up hobbies or would go out and have fun on the weekends, you would catch me working on a property until 2 o'clock in the morning on a Saturday. And I don't have many hobbies, unfortunately, outside of work, but I'm hoping all of that will change as my daughter graduates high school, goes to college, and, you know, I'm kind of left with more time to do some of these things. But really, a lot of sacrifices were made to make sure that she would be insulated from the vagaries of poverty that plagued my life as a child and unfortunately led to a lot of the decisions that really put me in a position of disadvantage.
Yusuf, for you, this path that you've been on, I'm sure there are a lot of mentors along the way. Are there any mentors that come to mind when you think about your journey?
There's so many. and this isn't unique to me, but there is no person who has experienced any success who can legitimately claim they've done it on their own. When I hear people talk about what they accomplished, I immediately
cringe.
Yeah, exactly. It's not consistent with reality, right? And so throughout my journey, and even the journey I'm on right now to remove this housing barrier for millions of people in this country, which I know we'll talk about. But, you know, as I think about just that journey, so many people have stepped up and been willing to help and support me. But this is what I often tell people, especially young people. I'm 100% confident that if you consistently show up, if you consistently show enthusiasm, intention, effort, people will invest in you. Not everyone. Listen, I've been working on this legislation I have called hundreds of people. I have asked hundreds of people to support me in this effort, and less than 10% have been willing to do so. But those handful of people that have been willing to help me are the reason that we are going to change legislation to extend opportunity to over 14 million people in this country. If you are intentional, if you are deliberate, if you show energy and effort, I'm 100% convinced, at least, and again, it's based on the sample size of one, right? My life, that people will show up and those people will help.
What motivates you? Because it seems like you are somebody who is motivated, right? Calling 100 people, having that grit and persistence. Yusuf, not everybody has it. People may give up after calling, I don't know, 20 people, 30 people. What gets you going? What makes you look at the world in a positive light?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I mean, certainly I would say in general, I'm an intrinsically motivated individual. Like I get up every day with the desire to accomplish something. Like part of that, again, we talked a little bit about it, was I was always working, right? I always had this drive to try to put myself in a good position. But in terms of the persistence, right? So that's what we're talking about now, is this persistence of not giving up. I would say a couple of things. One is that I've had success in the past, and I know the source of that success. And that success is persistence. So I know going into this new project, I already knew that I would literally be rejected by hundreds of people. I would be ignored. I would be ghosted. I would, all of these things, like I knew that was going to happen. But I also know that that moment of opportunity always has the possibility of being right after the rejection. Now, it doesn't always happen, but you just, like that person tells you no, in the back of my mind, I'm like, okay, maybe that means the next one will say yes. And eventually it happens. Like, trust me, you know this, I know this, but persistence is the key to any type of success. And so in my head, I just know that anything worth doing is not going to be easy. I always tell my daughter this. I used to have to tell her a lot when it would come to math, because, you know, as a kid, they would get like math problems and there would always be the optional math problem. And I would tell my daughter, that doesn't mean optional in our household. That means we need to do it. And I would tell her, I would say, if the problem isn't hard, then you don't need to solve it. Like, you've been blessed with the resources and the support to tackle hard problems. And that's how I feel in life right now, that if it's not a hard problem, then it's not the one that I should be solving.
Talking about something difficult, let's talk about what you're working on right now.
So what I am working on is repealing an exclusion to the Fair Housing Act, which denies housing protections, fair housing protections, for people with a drug distribution conviction. Mm. So in this country, if you've been convicted of possession with the intent to deliver or manufacturing or any of these variations of distribution charges, doesn't matter on the substance, can be marijuana, can be any illegal substance, doesn't matter how long ago the offense occurred, doesn't matter any extenuating circumstances involved in the conviction. You know, maybe you were dating a person and you just happened to be caught in a car with him, whatever. As a result of that conviction, you lose fair housing protections for life.
How will it impact people in this country, and who will it impact the most?
Well, community matters. Like, this is an empirical fact. Where you live determines the opportunities that are available to you. It determines your proximity to jobs. It determines your proximity to good schools. It determines the social capital that's in the neighborhood, in the community that you're living in and investing in, right? So community matters. And if you do not have fair housing protections, you don't have the right to live where you want and where you can afford, and the community that's best going to support your goals. You do not have that right. You're only allowed to live where someone's willing to extend that opportunity to you. Mm. And this applies from both the renting of a property and the ownership of a property. How I got involved in this effort was 2 years ago, we moved to a new community. At the time, my daughter was just a rising ninth grader.
And this is where, Yusuf?
In Allentown, Pennsylvania. And I was recruited to lead an organization here. And so we started looking for communities to live, of course, driven by school districts, right? My daughter's a good academic student. She's a great tennis player. We wanted to put her in a school that was going to help her be successful. I believe families have to have the ability to put their children in the school that's going to best support them. And so for some kids, that means a smaller school district. You know, for someone like my daughter, who is an extremely tall young lady, a lot of her confidence came from athletics. Just think about it. You're a 15-year-old girl. You're 6 feet tall. You know, there's just a level of awkwardness that comes with that. And so for her, a lot of her confidence that led her to be a good student, right? That led her to be a good, it came from athletics. And so for our family, yes, there has to be good academics, but we also wanted a school where there was a commitment to a positive athletic experience as well, right? Not just winning and losing, but a school that understood the importance of athletics. And so those are the things we were looking for, because those were the things that were going to best support my daughter. And every family should have that ability to make those decisions. We identified a community and I applied to rent a townhome in that community, and my application was denied solely because of my 25-year-old drug distribution conviction. And, you know, after I got over the shock and anger that this could happen, I learned that it was the result of a piece of legislation that was introduced 40 years ago by a notorious segregationist named Strom Thurmond. And for listeners, most of them will probably know that name, but if you don't know who Strom Thurmond is, he represents everything is wrong and has been wrong about this country, particularly as it applies to communities of color, immigrants, and folks like that. So as I realized, as I like actually processed that someone like Strom Thurmond today in 2024, or in that time, 2022, was limiting the opportunities of my child, and not just my child, right? Like if this is happening to me, this is literally every single year happening to tens of thousands of people in this country. The fact that our housing policy today is driven by someone with the intent, the motivations, the character of Strom Thurmond just did not sit well with me. And it has led to the last 2 years of effort to change this housing policy.
So where are you in that process now?
I'm thrilled to share that this month, we will have a bill introduced called the Fair Futures Act. I'm in the United States Congress that will repeal this legislation. However, only 2% of the bills that are introduced actually become law. I liken this to a very arduous hike where you've spent half a day and you get to the top of a peak and you realize your stomach drops because you see there's an even taller peak on the horizon. We have a much bigger hill to now climb. And so if anyone's listening to this podcast and shares my belief that housing policy in this country should not be dictated by people like Strom Thurmond, that we should not be erecting artificial barriers to opportunity in housing that disproportionately impacts people of color, then I would encourage you to reach out and figure out how you can encourage your legislator to support this bill.
Is there any such thing as a good argument anymore? One with sharp perspectives, fair and tough questions, that leaves you free to come to your own conclusions? Thoughtful discussion is missing almost everywhere in our lives. But you'll find it on Hear Me Out, Slate's new podcast. I'm your host, Celeste Headlee. Each week, we'll talk, we'll listen, and we'll ask the hard questions on issues that matter. Every Tuesday on Slate's Hear Me Out with Celeste Headlee. Join us.
Yusuf, I want to pivot a little and talk about ideas, because a lot of what you've done hinge on ideas that you have, like creative ideas, thought processes, and you call yourself activator of ideas. What does that mean?
My greatest strength is actually surrounding myself with people who have really good ideas. I'm not the most creative person. I'm a problem solver. I would say when we say activator of ideas, when we encounter a problem, I'm more likely to think about how do we solve it. I'm not one to sit around and say, oh, that was terrible. Let's move on and do something else. But I've actually had to learn to rein that in because as a father, a lot of times my daughter will complain and I'll start immediately saying, okay, well, let's do this, let's do that. And she doesn't want that, right? She just wants to vent and express her dissatisfaction with things. But my general orientation is to always look for a solution. And so I've just encountered a lot of problems in my life, for better or worse, and I've been able to solve a number of them. And so that's how I've activated ideas and opportunity.
In finding solutions, you created a company. How did you get funding for your goals after having been to jail? It goes back to having that record. How were you able to raise funds?
Well, this, I've especially learned this as I've gotten older. If you have a good idea, if you're able to convey your idea, and you're able to convince people you have the ability to execute on that idea, there's not a shortage of capital in the world. You may be rejected by 20 banks, but there'll be a 21st bank, or there'll be a 21st person who independently is willing to invest in your idea. But there is an abundance of capital and a shortage of people who can actually activate that capital. And so in my case, you know, when I started investing in property at the height of the foreclosure crisis, it was incredibly difficult to secure funding. But I met an individual who really helped me finance my first property. So again, just kind of believed in me, my ideas, my energy, saw my ability to execute, and decided to risk capital with me. And success begets success. And so, you know, after I proved that I could be successful in that first investment, I was able to do some other ones, got featured in an NPR story, and then people started reaching out to me. And today, capital really wouldn't be an issue for me, right? Because either I have a track record and I know a lot of people. So I would say, you know, for somebody who doesn't already have a track record and perhaps has a strike against them, like I did with having a criminal record, you're just going to have to work harder. My favorite definition of entrepreneurship is the pursuit of a goal or an objective without regards to resources currently under control.
Oh, wow.
So you can't, as an entrepreneur, say, okay, I want to accomplish this thing, but oh no, I can't do it because I don't have the resources to do it at this moment.
How do you measure viability, and when's the time to let go?
That's a tough one, and I don't have a specific formula. I would tell you, in my own experience, it is important to lift your head up from the weeds and all the work that you're doing from time to time and assess objectively, are you making progress towards this goal? And if you continue on for another year, do you see anything changing? And so in my instance, I remember doing that from time to time and saying, I don't have any money. I've been literally working nonstop for 2 years. But I remember looking at my situation and thinking, okay, but if I did this 2 more years, I actually see how I could make money. Like I've made enough progress in the intermediate time period that if I can just continue this forward, I see a path to success. And so, you know, you have to be willing to pull your head up and objectively look at your situation. Entrepreneurship is all about uncertainty. It's all about uncertainty. And so if the universe doesn't align as you hope, or in a way that's supportive for your idea, you have to be willing to make adjustments. And sometimes that means cutting your losses and pursuing a different opportunity.
You're right. I think for a lot of entrepreneurs, that's where they struggle the most. But I guess entrepreneurship also warrants persistence and grit. Grit, what we were talking about in the beginning, right? Because you can't give up. You can't. You have to believe in what you're creating and why you're creating and why there is a need for it in the world. Yusuf, I do want to talk a little bit about rehabilitation, because in America, we see, as you said, people are incarcerated for petty crimes, especially communities of color are. And there's so much focus on putting people in prison for various reasons, but we'll not get into all those reasons right now. But I do want to understand the rehabilitation process. In your experience, what did you see when you came out of jail, and what is lacking in rehabilitation process in the U.S.?
Well, reentry starts when you're behind bars, right? Reentry isn't something that starts when you're released. And it's so important for people to utilize their time as best they can when they're behind bars. So when I was incarcerated, I guess you could say fortunate in the sense that I was 18 years old and I was facing, I don't know, something like 60 years in prison for the drug distribution crimes. And no, I wasn't some major big time kingpin, but like our drug laws are so, especially back then, were so draconian that, you know, with a couple of ounces of drugs, you could literally be facing a lifetime sentence. And so it was a near death moment for me. Like, I don't know how else to describe it, but picture yourself 18 years old and your whole life is in front of you. There's so many things you have never experienced. You've never experienced love. You've never experienced travel. You've never experienced so many things, and yet you're in a position where your life could essentially be over. Because if I receive 60 years in prison, I'm not coming home until I'm an old man. And so when I received a 10-year sentence, I literally felt like I had a new lease on life. I knew that I would come home as a young man. I'd be in my 20s, but I would come home and I'd have another chance. And I had this resolve to not waste that opportunity or waste that chance. So I knew that most people who are released from prison go back to prison. Like, that's just a fact. Everyone knows that. And so I just logically thought, well, if most people who are here come back, it must be something that they're doing while they're here that contributes to them coming back. So whatever they're doing, I want to do the opposite. And so what you find when you go to these facilities, I mean, they're businesses. And so they're looking at how can they manage as many people as possible while still maintaining control, you know, with the least amount of resources possible, right? So with the least manpower. And so as a result, they give you things like a television, right, to keep you complacent, and you can watch Jerry Springer all day, or you can play games of chance, so like cards or dominoes, and you would watch people spend their entire sentence doing these things. And so I said, I'm not going to do any of those. I never had a TV my whole incarceration, never had an interest in it, never played cards, never played dominoes, and just tried to do the exact opposite. So that meant I read. That meant that, you know, I spent a lot of time in the library. I did a lot of reflection and journaling and these types of things, and really did everything I could to put myself in a position to not come back the moment I was released.
I hear you. I really do. But I also think there are so many people, Yusuf, who are not like you. So how do systems and structures can be placed in ways where people who are watching TV and playing cards, when they get out, they can be rehabilitated into the society in ways where they can lead a normal life?
It's funny. Maybe my daughter should have joined me on this episode. She would tell you, and I always say this, sometimes there is no easy way. I'm not saying that we can't devise systems that will be supportive of people, because the fact is some of these systems actively work against people. So, you know, you have a You have a drug distribution conviction, and as a result, we take away your fair housing protections for life. Like, this stuff makes no sense. So I'm sympathetic to all of that. And look, I'm actively trying to change some of these systems. This is what I tell my daughter.
You believe in it.
I absolutely believe in it, that there is no easy way, that nobody is coming to save you. And it's imperative. It is imperative. I would plead with anybody who's in the situation that I was in, that they have to do everything within their power to put themselves in a position to advance themselves and their families. Because the system.
It's not going to change overnight. You're right.
Yeah. And people like you and me, we're going to do everything we can to devise a system that's going to help you. But listen, there's been people like you and I and people a lot more talented than me that have been working to change this system for centuries. And guess what? It's still broken. And so my advice is there's no easy way out. Nobody is coming to save you. But I have to share this with you. There's this proverb where they say every morning the lion wakes up and he runs as fast as he can to try to catch food, because if he doesn't catch something to eat, he'll have an empty belly. That same morning, an antelope wakes up and he runs as fast as he can. But he often runs faster because he knows if he doesn't, he's not going to live the next day. And so, you know, while the lion's running for a meal, the antelope is running for their life. And I can just tell you, when I was sentenced to prison, I knew the moment I was sentenced to prison, I knew I was running for my life. And I knew I was running for my daughter wasn't born yet, but I knew I was running for my family. Because I told you, every person in front of me had been in the same situation that I was in. And I made the decision, and I implore every person, especially every young man listening to this podcast, to make that decision to run as fast as you possibly can for your family. Because if you don't do it, all you're going to do is push that sacrifice to the next generation.
What is the process of gaining that awareness and to discipline yourself around it?
I think everyone's motivation comes from different sources. For me, it really came from my experience as a child. I mean, I watched my mother humiliated because she did not have the ability to provide for herself and provide for her children. She did the best that she could, but I watched her placed in very compromising and hurtful situations because she just didn't put herself in that position. You know, as the youngest child, and my mother meant the world to me. And even though she was deeply flawed in many respects, you know, it's challenging for me because, you know, my mother passed many years ago. And so my daughter doesn't really remember my mother, but I often try to share her life experiences to her. My daughter doesn't have the same drive that I have. She's so much smarter than me, for sure. Like academically, she's so much more talented than I am, but she would much rather spend like a Saturday watching 90 Day Fiancé than, you know, like studying chemistry or something.
I see that with my girls. They look at things differently.
Yeah.
Because they have the privilege. They grew up in a neighborhood that obviously a privileged neighborhood, went to great schools, are going to great colleges. For them to understand the sacrifices, the disorientation, the depression, the rejections, they don't get it. Not right now. Or maybe it's just Gen Z. Who knows, Yusuf, whether it's the generation or the privileges that accrue to them. But yeah, you're right. I can totally see that with my daughters as well.
I'm more like a first generation immigrant. My daughter's second generation. She doesn't got that dog in her. She doesn't got that drive. Do you watch 90 Day Fiancé?
I do watch reality TV sometimes.
Okay.
Love is Blind or some crazy, mindless show. But that's because I just want to unwind, not learn anything from it.
No. And that's fine. I only brought it up because I watched this with my daughter. Like, so, you know, spending time with her means just doing the things that she wants to do and likes to do. But there's this character in one of the episodes in 90 Day Fiancé is all about like these immigrants trying to come to the U.S. But there's this beautiful woman from the Philippines who's dating this really ugly, you know, guy from the U.S. But if you listen to her, she's doing it because she wants to have a better life for her kid and for, you know, other kids that she wants to have. Like, she wants to change the trajectory of her family. And I told my daughter, I said, do you see the sacrifices she's making? Like, and she just kind of laughed because I think that like brought it home for her. And so, listen, the price has to be paid. And especially the immigrant experience. Like, I have so much respect for folks who are coming here and immigrants who have made it, because someone paid, and all immigrants, right? We're not just talking about recent immigrants, but even past immigrants. Somewhere down the line, somebody has sacrificed tremendously. And that's led to this kind of perpetuated advantage that you see. And so I feel honored and privileged to make that sacrifice for my family, because I know that my daughter and her children and every ensuing generation will never experience what I experienced and what my mother had to experience.
On that great note, Yusuf, if you were to define the United States of America in a word or a sentence, how would you do that?
Opportunity. I tell my daughter all the time, she is incredibly fortunate to be born in the United States. I've worked in India. I've worked in Nigeria. Like, I've traveled the world. I've been very fortunate to see many different parts of the world. And I was just in Colombia because I'm learning Spanish and how to salsa dance. So I was talking to my instructor and I said, would my story be possible in Colombia? You know, somebody who comes from nothing, found himself in prison at 18 years old. Could I accomplish what I accomplished today in Colombia? And she's actually a dual citizen. So she's lived in the United States. And she said, it might be possible in Colombia, but it would be much harder. And in fact, her cousin had gotten involved in some criminal activity as a young man and could not find a job. It was so bad that his cousin had to pay money to assume a different identity just so they could find work. And so I'm not saying America is perfect. I'm not saying there aren't other great places in the world. I'm just saying for me and my family, it's provided tremendous opportunity, and it's opportunity that everyone deserves. Everyone deserves it. And I just, you know, pray that folks are able to access it, whether it's through the systems that you change and that I help change, or if it's through hearing that they need to go out and run as fast as they can every single day. I pray that everyone has the opportunity this country allows.
This is so good. I am so glad that we had this conversation, especially because I had a whole week of a lot of no's as an entrepreneur. That's hard. And just having this conversation has given me so much hope and strength. And I feel like I'm almost reinvigorated after it. So thank you for doing that for me.
No, it was so much fun to be here with you. And I love the work that you're doing. And we're on the same page. The system needs to be changed. And I would just say, for folks who are interested in system change, it's not mutually exclusive to just focus on systems change and not also run the fastest race that you can for yourself.
Absolutely.
We can do both. And I think we have to do both to make sure opportunity is available.
I agree 100%. Thank you, Yusuf. This was great.
All right, talk soon.
Honestly, I needed it today because I have heard so many no's in the last 1 week. I was feeling so low. And then obviously I am sick, as you guys can hear in my voice. And having had this conversation with Yusuf, I feel so invigorated. I feel like I can make things happen. I just have to be persistent the way I have been for so long. Talking about persistence, I will ask all of you to consider subscribing to our Patreon. We do have a Patreon where we offer behind the scene look, offer audio that we don't release on our podcast. So if you're interested, find our Patreon link on our social media and subscribe to it for as low as $5 a month or $10 a month. It will really help us grow this business. These conversations are so important, and these conversations need to be part of our social discourse, our political discourse. Anyways, to those who are our regular listeners, thank you for coming back. And those who joined us for this conversation only, I hope you come back next week. This episode is produced by me, written by Adiba Hussain and me. The editorial review is done by Shay Yu. Our sound designer and editor is Hazik M. Farid. The music for Immigrantly is done by Simon Hutchinson. Come back next week when we have another inspiring story for all of you.